Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Michael Buehler, who is a professor of political science at Northern Illinois University and a research fellow at the Asia Society in New York City. He has contributed to political risk evaluations for private sector companies operating across Southeast Asia and is a regular contributor to news briefs on political and economic developments in the region for Oxford Analytica, a business consultancy company. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Buehler.
Hi, how are you?
Well, thanks, Michael. And the Malaysian Prime Minister, Najib Razak, he came out of the woodwork somewhat late on this growing political scandal over the disappearance of the passenger jet on its way to Beijing. There were 153 Chinese aboard, including a high-level delegation of prominent Chinese artists. The Chinese public and the Chinese government are furious that a whole week was wasted searching in the wrong ocean. What was your sense of the Prime Minister's first press conference after a great deal of contradictory information had come from the Transport Minister?
Well, I saw the press conference and I was actually quite surprised about the Prime Minister addressing this personally, this issue, and I think it just got to that stage because before that, his administration just really handled this whole incident really poorly. And so in many ways, I saw this as some kind of a face-saving exercise because they really showed their incompetence in how that was handled in the days before. So that was my first impression, that it really was some kind of a rescue operation of sorts for the reputation of the Malaysian government.
So, and this is a government that is authoritarian and apparently inept, but it's an authoritarian government. And the main political rival has been railroaded on trumped up homosexual charges, hasn't he?
Yes, I mean, this is a government that is in many ways a hybrid between a democratic government and an authoritarian government. So they really do have elections every couple of years. But then basically everything is done before elections that basically opposition figures or opposition groups really don't even make it to the elections. So in many ways, you could say, as you said in your assessment, that this is an authoritarian government and therefore probably just not used to the kind of scrutiny and critical examination that they're getting right now from the world media. And so the way they've reacted to this probably just shows exactly this.
But don't they have an economically powerful Chinese community in Malaysia that is obviously the population is dominated by Malays who are Muslim. They comprise 60% of the population. The Chinese constitute about 26%. And then Indians and indigenous people make up the rest.
Right.
So given that the Chinese government is furious with the Malaysian government, how does that sit with the Malay community? Because the Chinese community, because aren't there been tensions between the Chinese community and the Malay majority going back to the early guerrilla wars of the 1950s?
Sure, but then also the deal has always been in Malaysia that since the Chinese, as you correctly point out, control most of the economy, the deal has always been that they are in many ways allowed to do that, and the price they pay is that basically it's the Malays that run politics, and so there really has been this coalition in power since the mid-1960s that consists of a Malaysian party, a Chinese party, and an Indian party. And there, the kind of relationship is very clear that it's really UMNO, the Malaysian party in that coalition, that really runs politics, and the Chinese, in many ways, are influential in business, in the private sector, but don't really have all that much to say outside that coalition that is dominated by the Malays in Malaysian politics. So in many ways, a very vulnerable kind of community, and therefore probably we also see that the Malaysian government probably hasn't responded to that in a more appropriate kind of way.
So in terms of the we've talked about this being an authoritarian government who've basically silenced the opposition by labeling the leader of the opposition as a homosexual on trumped up charges. The previous prime minister, of course, was quite controversial, making anti-Semitic remarks. How much is Islam used in terms of politics? I know there was a ban on the use of the word Allah by non-Muslims that was overturned back in 2009. But that, of course, when it was instituted, sort of highlighted religious divides in the country, did it not?
Yeah, I mean, really, that has a long history in Malaysian politics. That basically, Islam is used as a political tool for all sorts of reasons. I mean, in many ways, the government under Prime Minister Muhammad Mahathir that you referred to before kind of mastered the art of using Islam for political ends. In the 1980s, we've really seen a kind of an emergence of religion in Malay society. People became more overly religious, and the Malaysian government really took advantage of this by expanding government programs for mosques, for example. They expanded subsidies for all sorts of religious programs, but then also in that kind of context, of course, defined how religion should be used and who can use religion in what kind of way. So in many ways, we saw in Malaysia an Islamization of the bureaucracy, and that really has its roots in a political strategy of that coalition that has been in power since the 1960s, which is dominated by Malays / Muslim Malay, of course. Yeah. So that's something that's been done for a very long time in Malaysia.
But this is not to say that the Saudi Arabian Wahhabi sect has had much traction. I mean, they've radicalized Indonesians, or some Indonesians, which led to the bombings in Bali by these al-Qaeda affiliates. But I believe the Indonesians have cracked down and eradicated most of these cells. Is there any evidence of Wahhabism, of Saudi sort of al-Qaeda-like Islam?
No, I wouldn't say so. I mean, surely a lot of these local groups that are rather radical are using maybe this discourse, or they're attaching themselves to this discourse, but we don't see, I think, an infiltration of Muslim communities in Southeast Asia by jihadis from the Middle East. I mean, a lot of these local radical Islamist groups have been around for a very long time, for decades sometimes, and a lot of these groups have the roots of their grievances are local and, as I said, historical. I mean, this is something that's been around for quite some time. It's not something recent. So a lot of these groups are homegrown, grievances are local. And then, as you pointed out, I mean, actually, a lot of these groups have been extremely weakened over the last couple of years, because a lot of these governments have been incredibly aggressive in going against local terrorism. And so therefore, a lot of these local groups, I think, don't really have the capacity or the competence to pull off a hijacking of a plane, if that really is what happened.
But there was a meeting that took place between a group of al-Qaeda terrorists in Malaysia that was monitored by Malaysian intelligence. And when the meeting broke up, two of the people at the meeting were tracked to Thailand, but the CIA lost them at the airport in Bangkok. And then they showed up in San Diego and they were involved in 9/11, these two. And this was the case of the hijackers in San Diego who were getting money from the Saudi embassy or the wife of the Saudi ambassador. They were not the FBI were not told about them. They went on to be in, pilots of one of the planes. I think it was the one that hit the Pentagon. So there's some history there, right? I mean, but that's not to say, as you just said, that there's no real homegrown terrorist groups there. But is it possible that outside terrorist groups could use Malaysia because of, some of the weaknesses in the system? I don't know much about Malaysian intelligence. Maybe you do.
You know, what is actually interesting is that also a lot of radical groups that are active in Indonesia or were active in Indonesia actually were hiding in Malaysia for quite some time. So they never really staged terror attacks in Malaysia, but basically stay in Malaysia for a considerable amount of time. They live in Malaysia. They establish networks in Malaysia, but then really, because probably also the rather oppressive government apparatus never really stage attacks in Malaysia. So sure, there is a milieu, so to speak, of radical groups in Malaysia. It may well be possible that some groups have people that are moving in that milieu, but I'd be very surprised if groups that are Malaysian or groups that are Indonesians are involved in this plane incident. So it could be that foreigners have used Malaysia as a transit zone, but I don't think that this is a group that is from Malaysia or from Indonesia or even from the Philippines that is responsible for this.
Well, one of the things that most affects Malaysia and this region, from my understanding, is the ecological devastation that's going on, particularly in Indonesia with these fires, these constant forest fires where they're burning down the rainforest in order to grow palm oil. Apparently, the Malays are also doing that in Sarawak and Borneo, destroying rainforest. And the area of Malaya, and particularly Singapore, often gets to the point where the air is unbreathable because of this. So in terms of the ecological devastation, are there political movements in both Indonesia and Malaysia, since the Malays and the Singaporeans have been the victims of all this smoke? One would think at some point or other they may be rethinking these policies.
Sure. I mean, they're protesting, right? The Singaporeans, every year, right, suffer from the kind of pollution that is coming over from Indonesia. Malaysians are suffering from this. But then the irony really is that most of the companies that are actually financing these operations in Indonesia are actually from Singapore or from Malaysia. So in many ways, it's also very hypocritical that these governments are blaming Indonesia for just burning down the rainforest while their very own private sector is actually financing these operations. So this is a very complex issue that goes across borders.
Well, maybe there should be a ban on palm oil then, if that's what they're, destroying the rainforest in order to grow palm oil plantations.
Sure, yeah. It's been discussed, right? But then there's also so much money in this. A lot of transnational companies, a lot of Western companies that have, millions of dollars invested into these operations. And so that usually is the bottom line, that you want to make money, and that is just one way to do that. And so therefore, I think that problem is just going to be around for some time to come.
Well, Michael Buehler, back to the hijacking of this plane, which, by the way, the Malay government, Malaysian government, still hasn't used the word hijacking for some reason or other. I don't know what the distinction would be, since it's clearly the plane shut off its communications and changed course. Now they're belatedly looking into the pilot and the co-pilot. You would have thought that would have been one of the first things that happened, but it didn't. So what's your understanding about, you know, how this is being discussed in Malaysia itself? The, you know, because the criticism from China is absolutely furious. But I'm just wondering how, what kind of Malaysian press you have, whether it's, since it's an authoritarian government, presumably they control the press.
Right. I mean, it could be that they've actually looked into the backgrounds of the – I'm sure they've looked into the backgrounds of the pilots from the very start. I think, again, what the fact that they're just talking about this right now basically shows is that there probably is a lot of miscommunication within the government. There is probably a lot of rivalry within the government as well. The Malaysian government in many ways is heavily politicized as well, so you may have different factions that – in many ways behind the scenes, moving against one another, and that probably has all an impact on a coordinated kind of way of responding to this incident. And so I think the fact that they're just now talking about that the pilots may actually have been involved probably is a consequence of that.
So just in closing, will this affect the Prime Minister's political fortunes?
I don't think so. I mean, he has a lot of other domestic problems, I think, that are, of more concern to him than this. This was just mishandled, but I don't think that within Malaysia this is actually going to make much of an impact, and also probably doesn't increase pressure on him all that much. No, I don't think so.
Right. Well, at least he's been able to get a stimulus package through to revive his economy, which is more than you can say for the U.S. government. I thank you for joining us, Michael Buehler.
Thanks a lot. My pleasure. Have a good day.
You too. Again, I've been speaking with Michael Buehler, who's a professor of political science at Northern Illinois University and a research fellow at the Asia Society in New York City. He's contributed two political risk evaluations for private sector companies operating across Southeast Asia and is a regular contributor to news briefs on political and economic developments in the region for Oxford Analytica, a business consultancy company. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking with an aviation safety expert about possible scenarios in terms of the fate of this Malaysian Boeing 777.